Iguodala to inbounds. Shumpert trying to stay with Curry. Catches one dribble, steps back, puts up a three. Won't go. Rebound tip taken by Spades. Final seconds. It's over. It's over. Cleveland is a city of champions once again. The Cavaliers are NBA champions. Cleveland's long sports nightmare has ended. The drought is over. 52 years. Time to celebrate a title. And the emotions for LeBron James, who delivers on his promise to come home and bring a championship to his beloved hometown.
It was this victory, a Game 7 win in last year's NBA Finals over Golden State, which not only capped a tremendous comeback from being down 3-1, it also culminated a personal triumph for LeBron James, bringing the city of Cleveland a long-awaited championship after leaving them in heartbreaking fashion just 6 years prior. NBA writers Brian Windhorst and Dave McMenamin chronicled this incredible journey back to local hero status in a new book called Return of the King. Brian, I heard you got most of your interviews with the Cavaliers players during this past offseason. That was obviously the perfect time to get them during a period in which they were still euphoric from the championship just won and would be most willing to divulge information they otherwise might not give if they didn't win at all.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, one of the things when you're pitching a book, you know, sometimes people get a little tense because books are sometimes where things get revealed. And that makes people nervous sometimes, especially professional athletes. You know, there's also the reality that, you know, they're not getting paid in most parts. You know, if you work for ESPN, you can't do a book with somebody like where the player is involved. So, you know, in a certain way, they're all reporting. But starting this process, I was able to say, and I literally said this many times, on the last page of the book, you will win the championship. You know, because it was that type of book. It doesn't mean there's not going to be some controversial stuff in there. It doesn't mean there's not going to be some stuff that some of the parties are not thrilled with. But the book ends in a happy ending for most of the people being written about. So that sort of, you know, tilled the ground, so to speak, to get people willing to talk to us. And we were able to get some pretty good stories, some stories that otherwise I don't think anybody would have known.
So as we go back to LeBron's first year in his return to Cleveland, the Cavaliers lost to the Golden State Warriors in the finals. Then in the rematch, falling back 3-1 and recovering, ultimately winning a dramatic seventh game at Oracle Arena that included a tremendous block by LeBron and a clutch shot from Kyrie Irving. Dave, for a city starving for a championship like Cleveland, and for LeBron personally, the prodigal son returning home and righting a wrong he created when he left in 2010, as the cliche goes, I mean, you couldn't have written this script any better.
It's kind of remarkable, and obviously it may sound self-serving for me to just trumpet how amazing this story really was, but for Brian and I to compile all of the individual moments and put it in a binding, it does boggle the mind. Not only everything they went through to get to that point to be able to win that Game 7, but then just the way Game 7 unfolded. You know, every single game in that series, games 1-6, was a 10-point blowout either way. There was no close games. And then all of a sudden, you have a nail-biter where it's tied at 89 for seemingly forever in Game 7. And then there's three signature plays for the three signature players on that team. You have the block by LeBron James. You have the stop by Kevin Love on Steph Curry. And, of course, you have the shot that's already been described by the Wall Street Journal as the biggest shot in NBA history by Kyrie Irving.
And before reading the book, Brian, I assume that the July 2010 evening of the decision by LeBron James would be kind of the start of your book. But in fact, it starts with a night in 2014, not in a game against LeBron's Miami Heat, in which the Cavs honored and retired the number of Zildjurnas Ilgauskas, who followed LeBron to Miami soon after the decision. And I guess this was kind of an unofficial, offering of an olive branch of sorts for the Cavs to show that they still can welcome in a player after he departs.
Yeah, the Cavs actually started to like plot trying to get LeBron back in about 2012. And they had reason to do so. LeBron had had a little bit of a thaw over the previous 2 years, and maybe, you know, not even like secret, like said on the record, he wouldn't mind playing in Cleveland again in front of, you know, reporters and television cameras and stuff. So they sort of launched a multi-year plan, and that was sort of the culmination of it, was they were going to retire his good friend Zdeno Sogalskis' number, and they didn't want to do it on a night when the Heat were there. They wanted to do it on a night when they could get LeBron to fly in and be there by himself. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was a couple of things they were trying to accomplish. One, they wanted to see if LeBron would do it, first of all, would be a litmus test on where he was with the relationship. Two, they wanted him to see how the crowd would embrace and the organization would embrace Sogalskis when he had left and with LeBron to Miami and come back. And, you know, they wanted to, you know, see if they could get him isolated from the team a little bit to try to work on him. And he was very businesslike about it. And I don't think the Heat were thrilled, but, you know, he did. He left the Heat in Chicago on an off night, flew over to Cleveland, and he came and watched it. And it was the biggest jersey retirement in the history of the NBA, I promise you. It cost the Cavs, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars to pull this off. And yes, it was for Ilgauskas, who was a good player, one of the franchise's longest tenured players, but not a Hall of Famer. You know, he's a two-time All-Star, and I don't think Michael Jordan got this type of coronation when he retired. But a lot of it was to sort of impress LeBron and say, hey, look at how we treat Ilgauskas. We will treat you the same way or better. And I don't know. Did it have a 1% effect on LeBron's decision? I kind of think LeBron came back because the Heat had gotten old and he liked the idea of playing with Kyrie Irving and maybe Kevin Love. But, you know, if it helped 1%, it was probably worth it.
After his fourth season with the Miami Heat, which resulted in a disappointing loss in the finals to the San Antonio Spurs, LeBron opts out of his contract, leading to speculation he might go elsewhere, with Cleveland, of course, being one of the potential destinations. When LeBron opted out of his contract, do you know if he was dead set on Cleveland, or was he unsure if it would be the Cavs, the Heat, or somewhere else?
Based on what we've been able to glean from our reporting, he was not dead set on the Cavs. Now, that was one of the teams on his mind that had a clear shot, and then, of course, that's where he chose. But, you know, just the way that season ended for Miami, and also just the grind of the LeBron machine, for better or for worse, it's not like you openly ask for it, but the attention that he brings to his team, it wears on people. And so you had the mental fatigue of that Miami situation, and then you literally the physical fatigue after they lost to the Spurs. Three of their top seven players in the rotation played their last game in the NBA: Shane Battier, Ray Allen, and Rashard Lewis. And if LeBron, somewhere in the back of his mind, knew he was going to return to Cleveland at some point in his career with something left in the tank to try to pursue a championship, that just seemed like his moment. And, you know, the rest unfolded, and I think it'd be hard for anyone to doubt that he made the right decision. In fact, and we detail this in the book, when he was leaving Miami, his, you know, quote-unquote secret motivation as he tried to capture that championship for Cleveland was several members of the Heat organization told him, I think you're making the biggest mistake of your career. And that hurt him because he felt like he was taken for granted for what he brought to the Heat franchise. He thought they should feel happy for him that, hey, I helped you guys out. Now I got to do this for myself. I got to do this for my city. And that was not the sentiment that he got. And that only fueled him to achieve what he wanted to do.
I know you were saying about LeBron openly speaking about potentially playing for Cleveland again while he was in Miami, but LeBron James, I mean, back in 2010, as you know, didn't just burn his bridges in Cleveland. I mean, he napalmed him. I mean, with his decision, Dan Gilbert, you know, provided scathing words in LeBron's direction shortly following the decision. Once LeBron opted out of his contract, obviously it was open for Cleveland to make their pitch. But how difficult was it for Gilbert and LeBron to mend fences?
Well, I think one of the things you realize when you're around the NBA or all professional sports is time has a way of healing things. And, you know, you've seen strange things happen. You know, just for example, this year, Shaquille O'Neal went back and had his number retired by the Miami Heat, and there was some incredibly vicious things said back and forth after he was traded. Right now, we have a real freeze in between Ray Allen and his former teammates with the Celtics. Don't want to invite him to a celebration of the anniversary of their championship, for example. I will bet you that down the line that those fences get mended. Will it be 1 year? Will it be 7 years? Will it be 12? I don't know, but someday Ray Allen will be standing side by side with those guys, because that's how life goes. So, you know, that is, you know, what happened here. And, you know, but LeBron was concerned about it. He wanted to talk to Dan. They hadn't spoken in the 4 years since he left. And so, you know, they did meet. LeBron requested Dan come alone. He flew down to Florida, and they met at a condo, sort of a neutral site, not in LeBron's house, but in a condo in Fort Lauderdale. And Dan really wasn't sure. I talked to Dan about this, and he wasn't sure what LeBron was going to say to him, and he wasn't sure how it was going to go. And so they, you know, I don't think Dan really truly 100% regrets writing the letter. I think he regrets the tact. I think he regrets the some of the things in the letter, but I don't think he regrets writing it. Just like I don't think LeBron regrets the decision. I think he regrets the execution of it. I think he regrets taking my talents to South Beach, becoming a defining thing for his career. But I don't think he regrets the idea of taking control of his decision and then using it to earn lots of money for charity. So I think both of them sort of had the same sort of conversation to have. You know, I'm sorry that I offended you. I didn't mean to do it this way. It was supposed to be business, but it became personal. And, you know, if we get back together, let's get back to business. And that's essentially what they agreed to. Although LeBron didn't make any promises to Gilbert that night. Gilbert left there not knowing whether this was something that would set up a return down the line or whether it would set up a return in 5 days or 5 minutes. He was completely in the dark.
So within weeks after LeBron re-signs with the Cavaliers, they acquire Kevin Love. And that was important considering the reason really LeBron James left Cleveland initially was the lack of a supporting cast. By getting Love, it created a new big three, him, LeBron, and Kyrie Irving. Dave, you and Brian described the meetings that took place in short order after LeBron joins Cleveland to try and get Love. Describe how intense those meetings were and to what extent the Cavs were willing to go after him.
Well, it was somewhat unprecedented, right? You already have your number one pick, Andrew Wiggins. And remember the hype machine behind Andrew Wiggins when he was at Kansas, this Canadian product being labeled the next big thing. And fans, Cavs fans, got to know him, too, because he was out in the Las Vegas Summer League playing for the Cavs, wearing the wine and gold, becoming a part of the Cavs story. And it became apparent that Love was the player who was targeted, LeBron felt like they would have a better chance to win with immediately. LeBron was not about to wait for the development of Wiggins 3, 4, or 5 years until he got to a point where he'd be entering his prime. And the tenuous part of the situation is they had to wait months to make it happen. Because of the nature of trading, a first-round draft pick who was already under contract, there was a date in August they had to wait until. And so it was kind of like the NBA's best-kept secret that this was going to happen, but no one really believed it would actually happen until the machinations were achieved.
Now, the head coach in LeBron's first season, at least back with Cleveland, and for the second half of the next one, was David Blatt, and the relationship between LeBron and Blatt was fractured at best. Blatt would be fired in favor of Tyronn Lue at midseason, despite being atop the Eastern Conference and having come off that NBA Finals appearance the year prior. Brian, was it purely a LeBron James-driven choice to let Blatt go, or were there difficulties in communication with other players?
No, if it had been up to LeBron, I think he would have been let go very, very quickly. Ultimately, I think the general manager felt that he wasn't able to connect with the players. this primarily manifested itself in how he felt he wouldn't hold players accountable, which is so strange because when he was in Europe, he was sort of known as a taskmaster. I mean, one of the things he was known for right before he came over to the NBA was during the Olympics in 2012, he took two of his best players, when he was coaching the Russian national team, two of his best players were talking during a timeout. And, you know, on the bench in a huddle, and he threw them off the bench, threw them in to go to the locker room. These are two important players in the middle of a game. And so the concept that that same guy wouldn't speak up in film sessions and wouldn't intervene when there were conflicts in the team is hard to believe. That's why I really don't know if David Blatt was ever allowed to be himself or ever felt he could be himself. But all of those contributed to David Griffin, the owner, the general manager, coming to the decision there needed to be a change made. And it was a risky change. You know, you fire a guy who's in first place and you aren't successful. You know, that's how you get fired if you're the general manager. But Griff, you know, he didn't see the players connecting, and he also felt that there was a lack of joy. Even when they won games, he felt that there was not a lot of celebration. The players weren't enjoying their success, and he felt that was another sign where he had to make a change.
One part of the book that I, and probably all of us readers, didn't know about was the heated confrontation between Ty Lue and LeBron during Game 7, or at halftime of Game 7 of this past NBA Finals. Profanity-laced exchange that led to LeBron walking out of the locker room. Dave, this to me, this further emphasizes the point that this team just seems to thrive on drama and angst.
Certainly, and that's part of it. Also, what's part of it is it shows so much of Theron Liu's personality and the stark contrast between him and David Blatt, because part of the reason why David Blatt was not successful outside of the wins and loss records, but not ultimately successful in being able to handle the tremendously impossible task of managing a team with the outsized personalities of LeBron, Kyrie, and LeBron, and Kevin Love, was that he would not feel comfortable challenging LeBron. He could never do it. He didn't have LeBron's ear. He didn't have his respect. And he, because of that, would let him kind of skate through things that he shouldn't have let go. He should have called him out in film sessions the way he was calling out other players on the Cavs roster. And here is Theron Lue, and it was reported before this locker room showdown, or whatever you want to call it, confrontation, that Ty did a similar thing with Kevin Love late in the regular season when, in front of the entire team, he said, "You're a bad MF-er. I need you to play like a bad MF-er. And if those guys don't treat you like a bad MF-er, you got to be a bad MF-er to them." And that was really what activated Kevin Love late in the season. And also, CBS Sports reported late last season that Ty Lue said, "Shut the F up to LeBron in a huddle." And it sounds dramatic, right? And even talking about this confrontation, and basically the Cavs went to the halftime locker room down 7 points, and Theron Lue said, "You think you're the best player in the world? I don't see it. Start playing like it." And LeBron was just taken aback that his coach, while he was holding the stat sheet, LeBron was, and could point out that I lead the team in every major statistical category. How dare you call my effort out among all the players on this court? Theron, it doesn't matter to him. There is another level that can be achieved. He used teammates with Kobe and Shaq and Michael Jordan, Dirk Nowitzki, Tracy McGrady, Dwight Howard. He coached the big three in Boston. He coached the other big three with the LA Clippers. He has seen what truly elite basketball was. And he knew that LeBron was capable of more. And, it's a risky proposition. If LeBron doesn't respond well to it, Theron Lue was not under contract. He decided not to sign an extension when he got promoted to the head job. He was betting on himself. He was going to wait to the offseason to deal with it, figuring if they won a championship, he would get a much better deal than what was being offered at the time. He took a risk there. The Cavs lose Game 7, and Theron Lue burned a bridge with LeBron James. He's probably not coaching the team this season. But as we look back at it now, what an incredible story that he pressed the right buttons because LeBron played even better in the second half and the Cavs won.
The Cavs are constantly filled with drama, and you know, and LeBron James is the drama king, no pun intended, tying it to his nickname. He now has 3 championships. He's certainly regarded as one of the greatest ever. He lives a very clean life. He's smart, charming, with aspirations beyond basketball. Nevertheless, he has these instances of like narcissism or this need for self-assurance. I mean, like I remember like last year before the playoffs, he unfollowed the Cavs on Twitter. It was just some weird things. Brian, you've covered LeBron since his days, his high school days at St. Vincent St. Mary's. I don't want to make you an amateur psychologist or anything, but has this been common dating back to high school, and do you have any idea as to the reason behind it?
I think in general, and I don't know what the term for it is, I think in general, he's moody. I think if you watch his game closely, you sort of see that he is moody in the way he plays sometimes. Sometimes he's in the mood to be attacking. Sometimes he's in the mood to lay off. Sometimes he's in the mood to shoot a lot of threes. Sometimes he's in the mood to, you know, dunk. You know, and I think, you know, if you're around him, you see that. There's some days where he's really engaged and aggressive, and other days where he's not. And I think it's difficult for his teammates at times because he's so important for everything that happens. And also everything he does is so studied that he, in some ways, he doesn't have the luxury of being able to have a day when he's in a bad mood because everybody sees it, or everybody reads about it, or everybody hears about it. So I think that partially explains it. You know, sometimes he gets in a bad mood for a week and does some stuff and everybody analyzes it and tries to determine it. And then the next week he can be in a totally different mood. But whatever, you know, negatives that come along with playing with him and whatever issues that come up with, you know, boy, I wish he wouldn't tweet that. I really wish he wouldn't have done this. I wish he wouldn't have said that. I wish he wouldn't have shown up a teammate like that. I promise you, everybody involved with him thinks it's a great bargain. The pluses that he brings, the advantages, far, far outweigh any disadvantages. And I think the Cavs last year can certainly understand and agree to that.
A great thanks to Brian and Dave for joining the show, especially at this very busy time of the year for both of them. The full title of their book is Return of the King, LeBron James, the Cleveland Cavaliers, and the Greatest Comeback in NBA History. If you'd like to hear all episodes of this program, be sure to subscribe to the Profiles in Sports podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, Google Play, and other places you listen to podcasts. Also, please check out our website, profilesinsports.com, as well as our Facebook page. And finally, you can follow me on Twitter @BrianWright86.